Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Lynn Alden. Lynn is the founder of Lynn Alden Investment Strategy and, most recently, the author of Broken Money, a best-selling book that has broken into the top 100 in Amazon and has been selling like hotcakes recently. And soon, it will be coming from my publishing house, The Safe House. I'm delighted to be offering Lynn's book, Broken Money, in cloth hardcover. So you can get it in paperback from Amazon. You can also get it in hardcover from Amazon, but it's the fiat hardcover with the glossy cardboard cover. But if you come to thesafehouse.com, you can purchase Lynn's new book in the hardcover that is cloth covered, and it's got a glossy dust jacket, similar to the finishing of Principles of Economics. So we pride ourselves on the safe house that we have these glossy books. So Lynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to. Thank you for having me. And here's the latest hardcover copy of Broken Money, the Safe House version.
This is the first copy. This is just sent to you from the printers, and it is our luck that it arrived to you just today, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's brand new. And one thing you didn't mention is that people can buy it with Bitcoin or fiat.
That's true.
Because, of course, one of the early questions I got was, can I buy broken money with money that's not broken? Uh-huh. And you were the first vendor to make that possible.
Awesome. Yeah, it looks great.
And so we have a very high quality book.
Yeah, there's just something about these cloth covers that is just so nice to hold. It's different from the glossy covers. And that's why I think, you can't really beat Amazon for distribution. But the way that they do that is that they standardize their production process. So I think this is a great little niche that I'm doing with the Safe House, offering these Bitcoin books in a low time preference version that you'll be proud to put on your shelves for decades and decades to come and pass on to future generations.
I agree. I appreciate you kind of putting that together. And I know that you also have that like that set now, right? So somehow you're competing with Amazon on price, which is kind of remarkable.
Yeah, you can buy Broken Money and the Bitcoin Standard and the Fiat Standard and Principles of Economics and Fiat Food, all five for $99. And also if you buy with Bitcoin, you get a 10% off. But I guess that's enough advertising for now. Let's get into the subject of the book. So why is the money broken, Lynn?
So as I argue in the book, a lot of it has to do with the order of technology that's come. And I think a challenge among, you know, especially hard money proponents over the past century or so, is that we've been making the moral argument for good money. But the order of technology has just made that very hard to do in practice. All the incentives keep grouping towards the other direction. And so what I argue in the book, for example, is that the dawn of the telegraph, so it was invented in the 1830s, but it was really deployed, you know, widely in the 1860s. That contributed to information flowing around the world a lot more quickly than physical gold could. And with information comes transactions. But it takes obviously a lot more complex information to do digital settlement, something like Bitcoin. And so there is basically a century and a half gap there where the only realistic way to process quick transactions is to centralize, abstract it. And with that comes a high likelihood that they're not that those systems are going to be corrupted. And that's what we've seen over the past century and a half, is the corruption of these centralized ways to try to basically do long distance accounting quickly. And so Bitcoin is the first realistic shot at trying to break out of that broken money trend. And the ramification of the current system, you know, a lot of us in developed countries think it's relatively fine, but one thing I point out in the book, there's 160 different currencies in the world, and every one of these like this little currency bubble. And all you have to do is spend time in any number of one of these, and you can start to see more readily why money's broken throughout the world. It's just not a good system.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is the point about the telegraph and the gold standard is something that I've never really come across in reading about economics of hard money. And I wrote about it in the Bitcoin Standard, and I argued that this was the reason that silver was demonetized. I basically said the telegraph is what demonetized silver, because with money moving at the speed of telegraph, then you no longer had any reason to move silver around. And so everything became credit, and then it was all credit backed by gold. But then if you demonetize silver, you know, it was good for gold initially, but then it was bad for gold because you demonetized gold later on. The sad reality is that once money becomes information, then money is no different from credit, because you're not moving the physical gold around, you're moving somebody's credit. Somebody's saying, I have this much gold in this vault, and I'm going to move the ownership of this gold from person A to person B. And so it's all become credit, and that's what money has become, credit. And I think it's a really important point, which most statist economists and fiat economists don't like to confront, that because it punctures the bubble of sanctity, of fiat money, in a sense. In their mind, money just has to be government money. Money is whatever the government says is money. And there are no technical or, you know, engineering reasons for why that is the case. It's just, obviously, there's a bunch of people who have jackboots and guns. And if they tell you toilet paper is money, you get paid in toilet paper and you use toilet paper as money. If they tell you gold is money, then gold is money. If they tell you their credit is money, then their credit is money. And trying to explain this in this way, I found it to be quite unpopular, and I've not come across, you know, I've not come across any counter argument to this. Have you seen anything? Because like a lot of people, fiat people, when they try and critique something generally they resort to incomprehensible noises and pointing and laughing and just, you know, this guy does not agree with us, ha ha ha. But they're incapable of actually formulating coherent thoughts into why this is wrong. Like, can you actually formulate another idea about why this is the case? And have you seen any kind of decent counter arguments against that? Have you come across anybody who's written something like that, at least in your book or some other book?
Not really. So the way I would describe it is that the emergence of a lot of these schools of thought, I think, not coincidentally emerged with the telegraph, like in that kind of era, right? So the well-known credit theorists or the Chartists, that began emerging around the time when money became so removed from the metals that people started to think, why do we need the metals? And then that led to a lot of development of some of these other types of models that are different from, you know, the models that were there before them. And so I do think it's valuable to have engineers look at the monetary system. I think the fact that you have an engineering background, and I think that your view of the telegraph affecting silver was spot on. And I referenced that in the book and kind of contrast it with Barry Eichengreen's view of why kind of the gold standard won out. And I cited, you know, more firmly in your camp on that whole thing. And I think the same thing is generally it's a technological impact that affects not just what we use as money, but even how we think about money. Because how you think about money then gives all you know, it's basically, it kind of builds momentum from there. And so I think that when you see people say that money is just what the government issues, it's essentially recency bias. They're just basically saying in the modern era, that's what money is. And then before then, it was really what sparked these things, I would argue, was kind of the shifting nature of technology, the need for centralization, at least in that era. And then that gave them all sorts of ammo, basically, just to start, you know, going out and doing this. In the current era, that's where Bitcoin's interesting, because that starts kind of putting winds in the sails of people that had the other view, right? It's like the technology can impact who's winning the argument a lot more than just winning the argument can. And so one thing I cover in the book, for example, is that with all the perils of fractional reserve banking, it's spread everywhere. And there's no country on a gold standard. And it's like, why do things win so thoroughly everywhere? And a lot of it just has to do with technology. And it's like, if you're going to win and take that back, it's got to be partially through technology. I mean, part of it's also spreading ideas and kind of, you know, pointing out the perils of what's happening to help people adopt that technology. But it still ultimately comes down to you need the robust technology to make that possible.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last with an ice colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, I think I agree. And in the Fiat Standard, I get into... I try and steel man the case for fiat, why fiat makes sense. And it comes down to more than just the fact that people put guns to other people's heads to accept it. And I think, yeah, it goes back to the idea that it is the speed of moving credit. So whereas in the Bitcoin standard, I focus on saleability across time, at which gold excels because it's difficult to make more gold. With fiat, I think you have to admit that it has better saleability across space because a central bank that is part of an oligarchy and a monopoly with the government, protected by the government, nobody's going to come and shoot the bank owner. That central bank is able to move money across borders faster than you can move a bar of gold. And so a bar of gold is better for moving value across time. You know, if you wanted to save money for 20 years, a bar of gold is going to do better than any form of fiat money that has ever existed. But if you wanted to do it for moving it across 2,000 kilometers, the central bank is going to cost a lot less. So there's no way around that. Moving physical money around is pretty expensive. And I think that's why as trade became more and more important, credit became more and more important, and central banks had an enormous amount of leeway where they could essentially create new money out of thin air, because having your money at a central bank and having it at a bank that is engaging in fractional reserve banking still meant less loss of value than moving a physical bar of gold around. And that's why people mostly suck it up and still continue to deal with their central bank, because they don't really have an alternative, or at least they didn't until very recently when a certain digital technology came about that changes things.
I try to also, like you steel man fiat, I try to steel man basically the credit theory in my book and basically kind of show that it came about with this faster era of money. And so as I kind of compared commodity theory of money, credit theory of money, kind of trying to walk through why people came to believe what they believe. That was like a big kind of chunk of the book. And, you know, that the whole kind of just process of falling back on whatever's the most efficient ledger. And in the modern era, these central banking ledgers have acquired so much network power, so much government power, that they become the fallback, the most liquidity, the easiest way to send money. And that's the era that we live in. And I think it's one of those things where it's hard to get around that until Bitcoin.
Yeah. Your central thesis probably in the book is that money is a ledger. Why do you say that? Why do you think money is a ledger?
So as best I can tell, the person who originated this was probably Ventus Casares from Argentina. There's not a lot of writing on the subject. He just basically talked about it like, you know, 8-9 years ago on a number of talks. It, you know, it kind of trickled down. And I've heard it from other people. Like I cited John Pfeffer who ascribes to that view. And basically it's the reconciliation between the credit theory and the commodity theory, because going back to your prior point, we were looking for kind of like strong arguments from that other side. I think that one of the strongest arguments from them, from the credit camp, if you try to steel man it, is that they point out that even in very early societies, credit naturally forms. It's a way, you know, if you're trying to solve the double quintessence of wants, there's really kind of two ways to do it. Either you have the most saleable good that simplifies all the transactions because it's on one side of every transaction, or you defer through time so that you don't have to have your two wants coinciding at the same time. You know, you can solve when you have a surplus in everything, you don't need anything from someone else. You can either use gift culture or credit to extend them what they need or want in exchange for knowing that there will be time in the future where you'll want something, and then you could call on that favor, call on that saving, call on that credit. And so basically there's, you know, kind of that anthropological research. And so what I do try to do is like I try to talk to people that have that view and show some of the limitations of that view and reconcile it. Because even in eras where credit was important, you still need a saleable unit of account, right? If you're just doing credit and there's no foundational unit of account, then you're ultimately just doing barter, just you know, more efficiently. The reason I do a ledger is because throughout the book, I keep falling back to the same question of who controls the ledger. In a commodity money, we're basically relying on a ledger. It's just that nature's controlling the ledger. They, you know, nature sets the bounds that are outside of our power to affect, you know, how quickly you can get gold out of the ground, how quickly gold can move around. And we're updating this kind of shared ledger amongst ourselves when we transact in it. And various credit-based ledgers are even more literal ledgers, but of course they're dilutive, they're censorable, they have a lot more, kind of mostly cons, but some pros, like this, mainly the speed issue. And so what I kind of do is just show that over the course of history, what we use as money changes over time. And it comes down to what ledger are we trusting, both for our savings and our payments, sometimes the same ledger, sometimes different ledgers. And one of the fascinating things is I really dove into Jevons' 1875 book, Money and the Mechanism of Exchange. And he talked, it's the reason it's interesting is because it's within that decade after the telegraph era started, really. It was sort of the beginning of the international gold standard. And he's just kind of, it was kind of like the same book written in that era. Like he started out talking about the history of money, kind of the nuances of money, how things developed, and then he's analyzing the current situation and the near future, and he's talking about how increasingly centralized it's getting. And the fascinating thing was he's talking about how it's become so efficient that you barely ever have to move gold. Most people don't want to have gold. They just want to rely on their bank because it's so much more efficient. And he's talking about how good this was for things. But at the same time, he's like, this is now levered 20-1. And we have to remember that every single one of these claims, like people, if 5% of people come in on regular banking hours and request their gold, this thing blows up. And of course, in World War I, it did. And so it's kind of fascinating, like not just going back and thinking about that time, but actually going back and reading what intelligent people were saying at the time when they analyzed the system in the present. And he did it objectively. He was saying, okay, here's all the pros. Here's what's remarkable about the system. He's like, it would be irrational if, the UK and America are trading goods and services. If they had two streams of like gold bars going back and forth, that'd be wildly inefficient. So like naturally we're gonna net this. Naturally we're gonna have basically paper and telegraph claims going back and forth with only occasional rare gold settlements, for resolving major imbalances. But then the problem is this becomes so efficient, it's almost frightening. And then it becomes so disconnected from the underlying and that it becomes fragile. And so part of the thesis was that when the transaction part got so much more efficient than the settlement part, it was almost inevitable that we were going to end up in this type of world, at least temporarily, because there was no better mechanism. Basically, nothing short of like a hyper-disciplined government would be able to do that. Like basically all the ways to fail, like there's basically 99 ways to fail for every one way to succeed. And so as that technology developed, it was naturally going to be centralizing, it was naturally going to be corrupted, and it was naturally going to lead to kind of the world we have now.
I'm going to quibble here with the word naturally, because I think had it not been for coercive government intervention and coercive government monopolies propping up this mechanism, I don't think it would have gotten us to where we are right now. I think in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, 90s, we'd have had a bunch of business cycles. They'd have been blown up. And then if governments did not interfere, if governments did not bail out the supposed geniuses of finance who had always, the story is always the same. I was just thinking of this the other day. There's no such thing as a genius in finance. Finance is a boring thing. And if somebody's being a genius in it, they're not being a genius. They're just using leverage. They're taking risk. That's it. That's the only way that you could be a genius with finance. Without leverage, finance is just plumbing. There are no plumbers out there that are celebrated for being able to lay plumbing for a house at 1% of the cost of their competitors. You got to bring the pipes and you have to lay them, and maybe you make a 1% improvement over your competitor, 5%, 10% improvement. But if you're in finance and you're making 100 times the returns of everybody else, you're not a genius. You're just using leverage and you're going to blow up eventually. And the only reason this stuff, I think, doesn't get eliminated from the market, the only reason we tolerate bankers being completely irresponsible with people's money, whereas we don't tolerate plumbers messing around with our pipes, is that governments are constantly bailing it out. So yes, this emerges. It does contain efficiencies, but it is also self-correcting. On a free market, eventually people realize, why are we keeping our money with this guy? He's obviously taking too much risk with this. And therefore they come in and they ask for their money, and then the person is exposed, and then the thing falls apart, and then the people who tried this stuff end up this is the key mechanism. It's not just that they fail and then they write an editorial in the Wall Street Journal about how they've learned all these lessons and how, you know, they retire and write books about how markets are so unexpected and we need more regulation. And it's kind of the price that they always pay for all the bailouts that they get. No, they get poor. Like in a real market, they actually have to sell their homes and go live in tiny little dinky apartments and work as delivery drivers, as dishwashers, because clearly they're not good at this finance business. If you lose people millions of their dollars, you should find another career. And, you know, they drive taxis or they wash dishes and they just stop being finance people. But the only reason this continues is because of government intervention. And I think this is the thing that is sometimes missing from this discussion, in that it's really only government intervention that allows for this insanity to continue. I don't think it would be sustainable otherwise. The problem with the credit theory of money, you're correct on the idea that credit itself cannot be a unit of account, because it's something that's fluctuating and it's something that's very subjective and it's not something that can be settled. And the other issue, as I like to describe it, is that credit just cannot scale. The problem with credit, and I discussed this in Principles of Economics, the problem with credit is that it cannot scale because credit requires some degree of trust between people. And so if you and I know each other very well, I can take your credit as payment for a good. I can give you apples and you tell me, all right, I'll pay you when it's potato harvest season. I'll give you some potatoes. I'll take that. And then I could have a piece of paper that says, Lynn owes me this much potatoes. But then I can't use that as money, except with people who know me and you. People who know me and you and know that this relationship exists and are able to accept that. And so it solves nothing. It's just, it can only exist amongst social circles that are bound by relationships of trust. And that's why I find this kind of David Graeber argument that, hey, look at this tiny little society where they used to exchange favors and credit, and therefore money has always been credit. I find that to be so ridiculous because, of course, you know, this is a primitive society of 200 people. They all know each other. They're all married to each other, and they all harvest together, and they all exchange the goods together. And so it's, of course, very possible for them to establish these relationships. But then when they need to trade with the tribe that is 10 kilometers away, how good is a Lynn Alden promise to a tribe of people who don't know who Lynn Alden is? They know nothing about you. And if you want to trade with them, you have to give them something that is either a consumer good, so you can barter, you know, we give them wheat and they give us potatoes instead, or you have to give them something that can be exchanged for a consumer good without it having to require trusting in any individual's creditworthiness. So credit is different from money. I think they're categorically different. And I think the confusion that people the confusion between the two is, I don't think it's entirely innocent, because it's government propaganda to believe this. It's in the interest of government. And so you see that all government-paid economists generally agree with this, that, yeah, money's credit, so money can be anything. We can make copper money. We can make toilet paper money. If the government tells us this is money, then if we all believe in it, it's money. And so, of course, the people who believe money can be credit also believe money is a collective hallucination, or it's a social convention. It's socially constructed. And it's... I find all of this stuff to be completely counterproductive for trying to understand the world. It's useful for sounding smart at dinner parties, you know, when you tell people, oh, the money that's in your pocket is not actually real, it's just a hallucination. You sound like you're saying something profound, but really it's something profoundly idiotic. It's not a hallucination any more than a car is a hallucination. I mean, if I hallucinate that the chair that I'm sitting on is a car, I can hallucinate it. And if a million people choose to hallucinate, we all go around saying, pretending this is a car, it's still a chair. It still won't function as a car. And for the purposes of people who are sane, There's a difference between a chair and a car, and they know what a chair is and they know what a car is. It doesn't matter how hard we hallucinate, the chair is not going to develop propulsion. It's not going to become an automobile. And it's the same thing with money. I think you can say that anything can be money, but in reality, if you use something as money that doesn't have the properties required for it to be money, it's not going to be money. It's not going to succeed at it.
Yeah, one of the angles I attack that in the book is kind of to point out that, to your point, credit is very inherently localized. And so credit is like closed source money. It's basically this closed permission walled garden ecosystem where it only makes sense when you know each other. Whereas commodity money is like open source money. It's like, you know, you can bring it between communities. They don't have to have any connection with each other, but it's valuable for what it is inherently, rather than relying on that other thing. So it's what ties little credit ecosystems together into something more foundational, or serves as, even within those communities, the final settlement, the thing you can hold that doesn't rely on anyone else's memory, anyone else's ongoing business success obligation. And so both within the community and between communities, it's what allows credit to even make sense as a construct. And going back to the prior point about, you know, what ends up being natural, I think a key way I approach this is that, in addition to shaping what we use as money, technology also shapes what political structures are even viable. And an example of that is that prior to the printing press, you know, like if you think of like the modern democracy, for example, where people over long distances vote on how they do things, that only works in a world where you have information moving very quickly. Like, you couldn't have a country the size of the United States being a democracy realistically before you had the printing press. Any kind of examples of democracy that were happening before then were like city states, where there's literally like a town square. And even then, there's usually like the kind of elite class in those places, like the literate class would be the ones that are basically choosing their political structure. And so what the printing press did was it opened up a new type of political structures. And I would argue that money does a similar thing, which is basically, like, you argue that without governments corrupting it, that the telegraph and these other things would not have led to the money world we have. But I think when we look around and we see that there are 200 countries and like every single one uses the same model, that basically there's no area that really resisted this. And when banking exists as kind of this like centralized ledger that has like this ability to move value quickly, when governments can control that ledger, it amplifies themselves. So it's like it feeds into what political structures are even possible in that era. And so that's why I view a lot of this as inevitable, in the sense that, you know, not that it necessarily had to go this way, but that the incentive weight was so hard in one direction that it kind of coalesced that way. And I think what you could argue is that with the invention of Bitcoin, it breaks that incentive structure and allows not only other monetary methods to exist, but other political, like the viability of different political structures can be more workable in a Bitcoin world than they were within this like century and a half of like this speed gap world. And so that's even as Bitcoin breathes life into kind of hard money views of the world, I think it also breathes life into other, you know, political preferences that don't match the current political overlay.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not too fond of the idea of money as a ledger. I think it's a useful metaphor. And I agree that it has a lot of teaching value to think about it this way. But I still like my classical old school Austrian understanding of money as just a market good, because I think at its core, it's when you say people money is a market good, it's nowhere near as fancy and as sophisticated as some of these other more flashy and perhaps even more informative ways of understanding money. Money is energy, or money is a ledger of the debts for society. I think it is useful to think about it this way, but the problem with these things might be that they lead to people taking them a little bit more seriously than just metaphors and understanding them as if they are strict definitions, and then basing conclusions on these definitions, which I find to be a bit of a stretch. So the credit theory of money is one of these examples. But I think if I were to steel man the argument against why money is not a ledger, I'd say that in a sense it does function like a ledger in many ways. So in particular, you look at the example of Rhystones and Bitcoin. I think those are two great ways of seeing money as a ledger, because Bitcoin is a ledger. That's what it is. It's a ledger of balances distributed over tens of thousands of nodes all over the world. And all that happens is that every 10 minutes, people who run these nodes agree amongst themselves that we're going to be updating these balances in a certain way. And that allows us to have a form of money. And the Rhystones functioned like that, in that you had these rocks that were stuck in the center of the town. And all you had to do was announce to everybody in the town that this is not mine anymore. This is this guy's rock. So it becomes his. But if you think about money like gold, the analogy begins to break down a little bit because of the fact of gold mining. People are out there mining gold. And that's not exactly in accordance with its role as a ledger, I would say. I'm not just exchanging the entries on a ledger. By going out there and digging gold, I'm introducing new gold into circulation. And that's subverting, if you want, maybe the role of it as a ledger, or undermining its role as a ledger. What do you think?
So I think one reconciliation there is that ledgers are market goods. So I don't view the money as a ledger and money as a market good to be in opposition. I would agree with both statements. Like I would have zero disagreement with the view that money is a market good. And so basically it comes down to the market choices people make in which they determine what ledger they're going to use for their savings, payments, unit of account, either naturally or because some power coalesces so much that it's able to force it on an area. And so the way I would kind of look at that is that, and the reason I phrase it like that is because a lot of, for example, gold proponents will assume almost de facto that money has to be physical. It has to be a physical commodity. And what I try to do there is show that really what we're doing when we pick gold is we're identifying a ledger as one that people can't screw with in a way that they can screw with most other ledgers. That basically no one can just create a lot more of it. They can go mine it, but then even the ledger itself sets very tight parameters for how much more units you can introduce. Like as you covered well in your book, stock to flow ratio, there's only so much more units you can introduce relative to amount that exists. And that's why people either knowingly or unknowingly gravitate towards that ledger. And what I like to do is think of it as like an abstract concept where if you had like a God mode vision of a region and all the gold coins or bars in that region, there's like a certain amount of them. There's new ones being introduced very quickly. They're being shifted around in physical possession or in sometimes just in credit ownership, which that introduces problems. But basically the ledger itself is moving around and people are basically using it as an accounting mechanism. It's just that nature is setting the parameters of the accounting mechanism and people pick it because it's better than other natural accounting mechanisms like silver or copper or shells. And at least in terms of, as you would say, saleability over time, it's better than human-made ledgers, because over years and decades, someone's going to corrupt the human ledgers, whereas gold resists that corruption because as long as you know that the rules of nature don't change, and as long as something about our understanding of gold doesn't change, like we don't have such great technology that we can go out and get crazy new sources of it, that this is a very robust ledger. And just the main issue is that it was too slow. And that's why in the modern era, you know, like as you cover in your book, money keeps flowing towards what is more and more hard. And what was interesting about the telegraph era is it's the first time where speed was a really relevant variable. And so the modern era is basically a harder money competing with a faster money. And we've been in the era where the faster money has been hard enough that it's able to basically overtake gold, because the overall combination of its speed and hardness, people just keep gravitating towards it. One thing I find interesting is like when I go to Egypt, more people stack dollars than gold, physical dollars, which it's kind of remarkable. And also when you look at the stablecoin market, there are gold-backed stablecoins, and they're just far less popular than dollar stablecoins. Even when you take away like kind of the leverage DeFi offshore trading stuff. It literally just when you look at, say, people in Argentina, people in Turkey, people that just want stable coins as payment or intermediate term savings, dollars are ironically outcompeting gold, even in that market where speed is equalized. It's kind of fascinating to watch.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's a very astute observation. If you if you go to these countries, I know in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Egypt, Turkey, a lot of people use these stable coins, and they use them as a way to access dollars, and it is the alternative way of getting dollars. And I think of them. We had an episode here with Paolo Arduino from Tether. In that discussion, I made the case to him that what he's doing is putting all the world's central banks other than the Fed out of business, because all these central banks do, you know, what the Egyptian central bank does is essentially they are dollar dealers. They take dollars from the American financial system and from the U.S. central bank and from the IMF and the World Bank and these essentially U.S. front, U.S. dollar front organizations, and they issue a stable coin supposedly backed by this dollar, which is the Egyptian pound, and they try and get their people to use that thing. And of course, they try and skim something from the top, but they try and do this impossible juggling game where they can finance the government's operation and finance government's welfare programs and finance government corruption and finance the military spending while trying to keep the value of the currency relatively stable in dollar terms. And of course, that's just an extremely inefficient way of doing it, because all of that Egyptian bureaucracy, all of that Turkish state, all of these inefficient industries that they prop up, all of that military spending has got to come from somewhere. And that's not going to come from taxes, because taxes are unpopular, so it's going to come from inflation. And so that's going to be a terrible way of getting your dollars. Whereas if you go to Paolo, it's just Paolo and, what is it, 20 people or 30 people, I think they have at Tether. And they are doing a much better job than all of the world's central banks and their governments at getting your dollars out there. They just give you a dollar, and they're very upfront about it. They don't try and trick you with nationalist slogans and propaganda. They don't have flags. They're not telling you where the nation's destiny depends upon us. They're just out there giving you dollars, and they're telling you, you know, we could drug you anytime. You're trusting us, and maybe you shouldn't. They say that in their white paper. They say this is a risk, is that we might run away with your dollars, and then you're left with a worthless stablecoin. But they haven't, and they've gotten tens of billions of dollars, and now it's an incredibly profitable business model, because they're taking these dollars, they're putting them in treasuries, and treasuries are paying them yield, and the people who are accessing those dollars on the stablecoin, they don't want the yield. There's an enormous demand for dollar stablecoins that don't even pay a yield, and it's continuing to grow, and it's quite interesting that it is more successful than gold. And I think it's uncomfortable for gold bugs, but the reality is gold's hardness is disappearing, and I think it's a function of the industrialized use of gold. I keep making this argument that because a lot of gold bugs think, well, you know, we can use gold for making jewelry and electronics and whatever. And they think that that's a good thing. But I think that's a bad thing, because you're taking it out of the monetary stock. You're putting it in industrial appliances, essentially burying it underground again. And so therefore, you're reducing the stock-to-flow ratio, because once you take gold and you use it for something other than a monetary use, it's out of the monetary stockpile. And so the stock-to-flow ratio declines, because now it's back inside a machine. And now if you want to use it as money, you need to go and dismantle the laptop, dismantle the phone, take out the tiny little grams of gold in it. And that's just another process of gold mining. So if gold becomes a consumer good, if it becomes an industrial good, if it has consumer uses, that undermines its monetary use. I think that's one thing that is undermining it. And the other thing is that it's becoming a serious problem, I think, the amount of fake gold out there. So if you go to Alibaba.com, you can buy gold coins and gold bars that are full of tungsten in the middle. So you can buy a 1 ounce gold, a 1 ounce coin should be about $1,900 these days, something like that. You can buy it from Alibaba at the same exact weight and it's covered in gold on the outside, but in the middle it's full of tungsten, and you can buy it, I think it's about $500 or something like that. So think about how common this must be if you can just go and buy it from Alibaba. And then how many of these coins are being passed around, because it's not very easy to detect them. You have to scratch the coin very deep in order to find the tungsten. Effectively, you're damaging the coin. So I think that means a lot of the coins that are in circulation are tungsten. And a lot of the bars contain tungsten. Of course, the only way to know with a bar is to melt the whole thing down. And so I think a lot of people keep finding fake gold in their holdings every now and then that gets taken out of the supply again. So again, it reduces the stockpile. And so we're seeing it become more and more of an industrial metal. Plus, of course, the point you mentioned, which is that ultimately the dollar moves around faster, and it is the global unit of account that everybody uses today.
Yeah, the modern era actually, in many cases, showcases that money is a market good, even better than prior eras. Because what the internet's doing now is it's opening this up. When you look at, say, stable coins, they're fully centralized. It's just that the central hub is not in the problem jurisdiction. And what it all it really is like a offshore bank for the middle class, right? So it basically just reduces the overhead that it takes to basically offer someone dollar access. Now there's even products that do give you the yield, like basically tokenized T-bills. But basically these are just centralized things that they exist at the pleasure of their own jurisdiction. So the United States could go after them. If they're offering, you know, Swiss gold, they have to, you know, get Switzerland's permission to be able to do that. But basically, if they can find a hub that they like and that other people like, they're offering, you know, basically access to that asset into a bunch of these other ones. And if you look at, you know, kind of the era we've been in, is if a government controls the banking system, which they do, they can control what wires go in and out of the country. Of course, they control the ports of entry, so they can control how much gold or cash can be able to come in, you know, for the most part. And so they have pretty tight financial firewalls around their borders. And what Bitcoin does, and to some extent what things like stablecoins do, is they start piercing those borders and let money be more of a market good again. So there's just more and more ways for people in these countries to access things like dollars, or preferably access things like Bitcoin, that they couldn't do prior to, you know, years and a little over a decade ago. And so that's kind of opening all that up, which I think is really powerful. And going back to the gold point, what's fascinating is that the smaller coin you get, like if you go from, say, the 400 ounce bar down to the smaller bar, down to like the 1 ounce gold coin, down to like the half ounce, the smaller you go, the more of a premium you pay relative to spot gold. And part of that, it's an economy of scale thing, but it's also a verification premium. Basically, the smaller you go, the harder it is to fill it with tungsten. Whereas, like, you know, if you buy a massive gold bar, most of it could be filled with tungsten. It's harder to verify. Whereas when you're buying a smaller gold coin, you're paying a huge markup, but you're getting the near assurance that there's no one slipped tungsten into this like quarter ounce gold coin. It's just uneconomic. The surface area relative to density is huge. It doesn't make any economic sense for someone to take the time to try to put a little slice of tungsten in this like little slice of gold. But then you end up paying this huge markup, which makes it worse money. Now, gold still has, like, if you do a ranking of monetary saleability, the way it generally works is that in a country's own jurisdiction, because of their like legal tender laws, they can create like 10 out of 10 saleability inside their own jurisdiction. But then once money leaves that jurisdiction, unless it's the dollar or, you know, to some extent the euro, that saleability disappears very quickly. So, you know, I have Egyptian pounds in the drawer next to me, and it'd be very hard to do anything with them here in New Jersey. But then the remarkable thing is, even a country like Norway, I have some of their currency. It's one of the stronger currencies, one of the wealthiest nations per capita. It's a small, non-saleable money, and so I would have pretty much equal trouble doing anything with my Norwegian currency as my Egyptian currency here, where I'm very far from either of them. The dollar, however, is saleable in many countries around the world. If you bring a gold coin with you, that's highly saleable around the world, even though, you know, in any given jurisdiction, a dollar will sometimes be less saleable than the local currency just because of legal tender laws. And it might take you more time to get a gold coin off your hand than the local currency, but they still have a higher saleability than any of these other currencies have outside of their own jurisdiction. And when you look at Bitcoin, it's you know, over the past 10 almost 15 years, it's rising up the salability tree. So it doesn't have the density of salability that currencies have in their own kind of like local monopoly. But when you think about it on a global scale, what is the ranking of global money's, you know, salability wise? It's probably dollars and gold are like 1 and 2. The euro is probably 3. Silver is up there. And then you start getting into like basically Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin's either in the top 5, or if it's not there, it's at least in the top 10 of things that you could bring with you. And in a lot of urban centers, you could get Bitcoin off your hands at something close to the market price a lot faster than you can other types of money. And so it is, we're seeing this thing monetize in real time. And then we're also seeing the dollar market eat into emerging market currencies in real time. Because when you look at, say, global international trade, the dollar has a certain percentage. But when you look at stable coins, which in some ways is a freer market, it's like 99% dollars, like more than 99%. Like it's like the money trends towards one way harder there, where there's no borders, or where borders are pierced through. And just everybody just says, you know what, if I want a currency, I might as well have the dollar. You don't see a big market for Swiss franc stable coins. You don't see a big market for euro stable coins. You don't see a big market for gold stable coins, which is actually kind of surprising to me. You just see such a strong demand for dollar stable coins.
Yeah, that's very astute. I think the point on the transaction fees being so small for the small denominations of gold is a very good one. And I think this is another one of these uncomfortable facts that gold bugs don't like to think about. And I know this because I was one of these gold bugs. In theory, on the charts, gold may look like it did well. And there were periods, believe it or not, when it did do well. The period from, say, 2006, 7 to 12, 13, well, around 11, 2011, I think, it did pretty well around that time. And yet, if you're actually buying physical gold, if you're taking delivery of physical gold, you're paying such an enormous premium to be buying it. And then when you're selling it, you're also paying a premium. And people like me who are pretty ideological about it might like to forget about this and not calculate the numbers. But if you think about it from a practical perspective, this is what money is about. And when you read Karl Menger, what makes money money is the fact that it is the good that has the smallest bid-ask spread. It's the good that when you take it to the market in large quantities, if you want to get rid of it in large quantities, you're not going to have a significant impact on the market. It's the good where you can have the least significant impact as a seller. So if you have a Van Gogh painting, there's only so many Van Gogh paintings out there. So if you choose to make Van Gogh paintings your store of value, and you're some sovereign wealth fund that holds $1 billion of Van Gogh paintings, and then you decide that you want to sell half of these Van Gogh paintings so that you can buy some other thing, so you need to raise $500 million. Well, if you drop $500 million of Van Gogh paintings on the market on a weekend or a weekday or a week or a month, you're going to seriously depress the price of Van Gogh paintings. And the same is true for real estate. If you invest in real estate and then you drop a large amount of real estate properties in a certain area on the market, that's going to bring the price significantly down. And the same is true for pretty much everything. And money is the one good that has that the least. Money is the one good that resists this the most, because it is the one good in which people have increasingly large cash balances. And realistically today, that's the dollar. And that's the dollar by a country mile. I'm not going to go ahead and give it the honor of saying there is no second best, because it's not true. There are second bests. But I think Bitcoin is catching up. So Bitcoin's spread is declining significantly. So 5 years ago, if you wanted to buy Bitcoin from a dealer, you usually, there was a bigger sort of spread that you had to pay a few percent extra premium in order to buy it. And then you had to sell at a few percent extra, a few percent less in order to get rid of it. But that keeps shrinking because the liquidity keeps growing and growing and growing. And of course, because it is one good that is fungible all over the world and it's easy to send, that makes the market's liquidity grow more and more.
Yeah, and it's because I talk to institutions sometimes or large investors, and we can see the liquidity, like that saleability and liquidity goes up over time. And what's interesting is until it's large enough, it doesn't even interest the next level of buyers. Like, you know, when Bitcoin had $1,000 worth of trading volume, someone couldn't just throw $1 million in there. When it had $1 million in daily trading volume, you couldn't just, you know, Michael Saylor couldn't just throw $1 billion into it. When it has billions of dollars of trading volume, there's still $1 trillion of pools of capital, like giant insurance funds or sovereign wealth funds or large, you know, very large endowments. And it's still a small market for them. They'd have to be careful about moving the price. But it's like the more liquid it gets, the more interesting it becomes to these larger, you know, potential cash balance type of entities or investment entities. And so you can kind of see it just over, that's another, it's not just price in which it monetizes, it's that liquidity over time. And we kind of just see that stepping up more and more. I think that's a really big factor. And that's also, and that's when people talk about kind of the other altcoins, again, it's like they're like basically Van Gogh paintings. They're all these little tiny mini pools of liquidity. And whereas when a money gets more liquidity, that liquidity makes it better money. You know, when I talk to gold enthusiasts, I think that's a key thing. Basically, I think emphasizing the portability is at least in my discussions or my writings, I find that emphasizing the portability matters. Like, I mean, for example, I go between the United States and Egypt every year. If I'm in Egypt, I can't access any gold I might have in the U.S. If I'm in the U.S., I can't access any gold I might have in Egypt. Good luck bringing any significant amount of gold out as a bearer asset. And the way that most people hold gold is they'll just hold it in like an ETF or something. But then you're in the realm, if you don't care about the bearer properties, which is with gold is kind of hard to do, because if you want that verification premium, you're going to pay a premium for the smaller, more verified coins. But if you don't care about the bearer aspect of it, like the fact that you can self-custody it, if you're going to put it in ETF, well, now you're competing with like Apple stock. Now you're competing with, you know, the monetization of savings is people can say, well, I can either choose gold or I can choose the S&P 500. When you look at, say, Apple stock, it's this big profitable company. They actually reduce their shares every year because as long as their business is successful, they keep reducing their shares. And when people can just buy like a percentage of their national equity, so they don't have to rely on one company risk, they can just buy 500 of them. That is a big competition for gold, because for people that don't care about the bearer nature, you know, another 3,000 tons of gold are coming to market every year. That's supply that has to be absorbed. The S&P 500 has been able to hold its value better with dividends included compared to gold. And so between the two factors, that if you take gold in your possession, you're going to have all these frictions. If you don't take gold in your possession, then you're competing with a sea of other monetizable assets from which it's one of many. And so it's not surprising that its overall monetary premium has kind of reduced as a share of global assets over time. But Bitcoin fixes a lot of that. Bitcoin has, you can it's a bearer asset with zero terminal supply. And that's just, it's basically, it's something that stocks are going to have a much harder long-term hurdle for outcompeting. So it's a much more compelling case for your savings. The bearer nature of it is way easier. And then you basically save up optionality. So, you know, right now, a lot of institutions or just large investors will view Bitcoin as like a risk asset. But I think the smarter ones also view it as an optionality asset, that if you hold Bitcoin, you now have access to global portable money. You can make unsensible transactions. You can bring your wealth with you if you want to change jurisdictions. And so just across the board, the way it ranks in all these different metrics of problems it can solve is very, very high. And the past kind of 50, you know, the past 40 years or so of this, like, let's say the modern era of declining interest rates, ever higher valuations, that's been a very difficult environment for gold to operate in. And what Bitcoin is, I think, just a far more suitable competitor. And it just comes down to continuing to test it, see if it survives any possible attack thrown at it. And as it does, it just acquires more liquidity and pulls more and more liquidity towards it, which then opens itself up to the next level of potential buyers.
I agree entirely. I think you share my frustration, I think, with the common criticism of Bitcoin, which is, well, Bitcoin has not won yet, so clearly it will never win. Bitcoin has not overthrown the dollar yet, so clearly it will never overthrow the dollar. And it's just, I find this to be extremely short-sighted. I think a lot of fiat economists, and I should say fiat adjacent economists, people who might pretend to be Austrian or sympathize with Austrian ideas, or pay lip service, I should say, to Austrian ideas, have this idea that, well, I saw some poor people in a hyperinflationary country and they were using dollars. Checkmate Bitcoin. Bitcoin is never going to recover from this. And of course, I mean, the dollar is the biggest monetary network that has ever existed. You're not going to dethrone it in a day. You've got hundreds of trillions of dollars in liquidity, in dollars and dollar instruments, second layer and third layer dollars out there all over the world. You can't just have the entire world switch from this to a new form of money overnight. But the question is, in what direction are we heading? And we see it. We see bigger liquidity. And the bigger the liquidity on Bitcoin, the more feasible it becomes for people to switch to Bitcoin. And it's just, it's very limited static thinking when you just can only see it in terms of where it is right now. But as you describe, as the liquidity grows, it becomes more attractive. And the liquidity has been growing enormously quickly over the last 15 years. And it's likely to continue to grow, I think. You need to offer a very compelling case why the trend of the last 14, 15 years is going to reverse. And I don't think anybody has succeeded in offering something like that. So people like George Selgin or Nassim Taleb may have offered explanations for why they think it's not working, or it's not worked, or it won't work. But they don't have anything substantive to say why the trend of the last 15 years can't continue. And the reality is, if over the next 15 years, Bitcoin has 10% of the annual growth that it had over the past 15 years, it becomes bigger than the bond markets of the entire world. It becomes the most liquid, largest, most saleable good in the world. It doesn't have to match the performance of the last 15 years in order to win. It needs to just not shrink in terms of its liquidity. And I think, given the fact that we don't see reasonable attack vectors where the thing can be compromised on a technical level, it's a pretty bold call to say that this trend is going to reverse, wouldn't you say?
I agree. And I think another thing we share in common is the importance of cash balances more than just medium of exchange. The reason that's kind of complex to talk about is because they feed on each other in a certain way. So for example, ironically, you know, people will criticize the Lightning Network as, you know, being small, not handling a ton of volume. But I would make the argument that I would hold maybe less Bitcoin today if the Lightning Network didn't exist, because the existence of the optionality of the Lightning Network increases the value, my perceived value of my Bitcoin, because it increases the overall usage of my Bitcoin should I ever want to, right? So at the current time, I'm not in an environment where I normally have trouble making payments. It's just not a problem for me. It is for some people in some areas, but it's just not a problem for me. And I'm in an environment where every transaction would be a taxable event just because of the currency monopoly I exist in. And so the way that I perceive Bitcoin is that the convertibility is more important than the current number of goods and services that are actually happening in Bitcoin. So for example, if the only thing I could ever do with my Bitcoin is take it to like one of 8 exchanges in the world and convert it for fiat, that would not be a very useful system to me, because I would say, well, I mean, governments could just shut down these 8 entities and it would be useless. The fact that there's tons of exchanges in the world, a number of merchants that accept Bitcoin, a number of just people that I can just convert it to multiple different currencies, and then, you know, I'm in their like RK token, I'm in their little like currency monopoly with my bearer asset. There's multiple things I could do with it. So I think that a thing that gets left out of the technical discussion, or people that are too focused on the medium exchange element, is that they don't consider the importance of optionality. It's in some ways the middle ground between the cases, in the sense that cash balances are very important, but part of what makes that cash balance useful is the overall liquidity and the overall number and geographic breadth of the conversion points in which I could use Bitcoin. And as long as those numbers keep going up, you know, that there's more liquidity, not just in dollar markets, but in many markets around the world, the more people learn about Bitcoin, the more people realize they would like some, the more people that then get, they like it so much, they want to build on top of it, or they want to educate others about it, that network effect is very powerful, and there's no clear thing that would end it other than some sort of disastrous bug or something like that. Or, you know, I think one of the biggest setbacks would be if the US government kind of like went to the mattresses on Bitcoin, you could damage the liquidity of it severely for a long period of time. But it's not even clear that that would be enough. Like, eventually it could even route around that problem. It would just kind of be like a temporary setback, most likely. And one model that I use is that when you have emerging market currencies start to fail, they get dollarized from the bottom up against their will, right? So if Argentina is in a constant currency spiral, more and more Argentinians are going to hold dollars, gold, dollar stablecoins, Bitcoin, whatever the case may be. They're going to hold something else. And they can try to add frictions, like they can try to make it harder to send money to exchanges, but people can still use peer-to-peer stuff. That, you know, the bigger the incentive, the ability, the bigger they're, you know, they're more likely to work around those frictions to get out of the problem. And so basically the dollar is this predator for every emerging market currency that starts to fail. The dollar is like right there, just always over them, always kind of like with a knife to their neck, ready to jump in should they start to, you know, either let down their capital controls or start to have such an inflationary problem that people gravitate towards it more. And when we look at the developed market currencies, including the dollar, they're on a similar trajectory as the emerging markets. It's just a much there's so much more of a capital base. There's such stronger network effects that it's still kind of trending in the same general direction. So we've had 40 years of falling interest rates, 40 years of rising debt as a percentage of GDP, and those falling interest rates have offset the rising debt as a percentage of GDP. So if you double your debt, but you cut your interest rate in half, your interest expenses are still manageable. They haven't really changed. And so that's the position that the US and a lot of these other countries have been in. But now we're at a time where interest rates have hit zero. They were zero for a while. They're bouncing off of zero. The fiscal situation is getting worse because a lot of it's tied to demographics, and they didn't really account for that. So that's all worsening at a time when interest rates are no longer falling. And so as these developed market currencies, I think in the long run, trend somewhat, you know, directionally similar to what we've seen in emerging markets, just more overall monetized fiscal deficits that no politician really knows how to control. Bitcoin is like the predator that's always out there, ready to absorb and kind of monetize from the bottom up. And the worse it gets, the more people are going to be willing to overcome frictions. Right now in the developed world, people are not really willing to overcome frictions because it's workable enough. But the worse things get, as we see in emerging markets, the more people gravitate. And, you know, Chainalysis has they call it the crypto adoption index because they don't segment which asset people are holding. But it's like when you look at countries ranked by how much people use quote unquote crypto, 18 out of 19 of the top 20 are emerging markets. The only other two were like the US and the UK. And it's no surprise. Basically, the ones with the worst monetary environment that still have that are tech savvy, that, you know, that have access to the technology and the interest to do so, they're the ones that are early adopters of this, of Bitcoin and stable coins, whatever the case may be, because they have the most friction. So I think that in the intermediate term, the dollar is having a lot of inroads, you know, thanks to stable coins, but the dollar itself is also on an unsustainable path. And Bitcoin's always there to do to the dollar what the dollar is currently doing to other countries.
Exactly. And I think it's remarkable that people who see the bullish case for the dollar can't see the bullish case for Bitcoin often, because it's just the same thing. If you're in Argentina, it's very hard to make pesos. It's very easy to make pesos. It's very hard to make dollars. Well, it's even harder to make Bitcoin, and it's harder to make Bitcoin than in the US. And the US is definitely abusing its exorbitant privilege, as the French used to call it, of printing money. So you would expect, if the US had a sort of responsible monetary policy where their money supply was growing at, let's say, 1 or 2% per year only, you would have seen enormous dollar appreciation over the past 10, 20 years, just because everybody in the world, as the world globalizes, as you were saying, with the stable coins, just the bullish case for holding dollars rather than holding your local shitcoin is enormous all over the world. And you would see that reflected on the dollar price. And the reason you don't is because the US government and its banking cartels are eating up all of that monetary premium that would be accruing to dollar holders otherwise. But that's a deeply structural issue that I don't think can be fixed in any meaningful way. There's no way to curb this process from continuing. All right, well, there's an enormous amount of interesting stuff in your book to get into. Perhaps one thing I wanted to get your thoughts on, I could ask about a lot of things, but tell us about your ideas on free banking and central banking, Chapter 7. What's your thesis there?
So there, what I did was kind of catalog the centralizing forces over time. Well, you start with custodying, then you get to free banking, then you get to central banking. And a challenge, and this is why Bitcoin's interesting too, is that when you have banks as basically honeypots, where that's where the gold is, that's where people are using as their ledger, the government only has to go, depending on the size of the country, the government only has to go to a couple dozen banks or a couple hundred banks, and they've got the gold now, they've got the control now. Basically, the number of enforcement points is low, and therefore it's capturable, it's centralizable. Whereas the reason that Bitcoin's interesting is that the enforcement point is now on the individual, right? If they want to impose and say, you can't have Bitcoin, well, you've got to do it on the individual level now, which is costly and kind of puts your cards on the table for the government. Like, instead of, you know, a lot of things can be controlled by just controlling the banks and people don't really know what's going on. But if you go after someone for using Bitcoin or something like that, or using stable coins in another country, that's the government being more transparent about their intentions. They're basically saying, you can't, that's information we don't want you to have. And so when we look at that chapter on free banking and central banking, basically we have this, like, almost like when you read that chapter, it's like watching a frog get boiled slowly, like that common saying where, like, they don't know what's happening, where, like, every step of the way, you kind of chip away one more piece of centralization. And so you start with basically a good underlying structure of money. So you know the government just defines a unit of account for money, it mints some coins, but banks are able to, you know, any bank can basically form itself, hold the gold, offer banknotes. Now I do talk about the perils of fractional reserve banking in one of the chapters. Basically, these institutions are now trying to compete. But then over time, as they inevitably run into liquidity crises from fractional reserve banking, or as the government needs to finance itself for war and has the ability to go after these honeypots, it just starts centralizing them over time. And so unseen to people that are using these ledgers, the ledger that ties them all together is being more and more controlled in a way that most people are just, you know, most people are not financial experts. And especially in that day, information traveled more slowly. So most people don't know the underlying things that are happening to the banks that's centralizing them more and more. And we kind of see that, like, they just gravitate together under government control towards this, like, fully controlled centralized ledger. And then one of the outcomes there is that whole ledger becomes highly surveillable. Because if you have non-inflationary money, like if you have gold-backed money, and people can either hold gold or they can hold banknotes that are redeemable for gold and don't really inflate that much, they can engage in a lot of private transactions or have private holdings. Whereas when you have highly inflationary money, people need the yield to manage how quickly they get diluted. They have to mitigate how quickly they get diluted. They need that yield. So it pulls more resources into the banking system, which is controllable by the government. And then everybody's on this surveillable ledger now. And that's been the tendency. It's almost like this black hole. And almost every country's gone through it. I use the American case because that's the one I most researched on. And you just see this kind of centralizing force over time. And that's a part of why I view the technology angle as, I don't want to say deterministic, but having a very big deterministic element to it, at least, which is that it's like that the phrase of, like, the narrow path, right? There's the path of failure is very wide. All the ways it could be centralized given time are very wide, whereas the path of not having that happen, like if a whole culture said, okay, we're going to set up all of our banks, we're going to do full reserve banking, you know, commodity credit, not circulation credit. Sure, that like utopian society could, like, resist this structure, but all the kind of incentives and the technology that enabled it kept pulling towards a more and more centralized and surveillable ledger. And then another thing that I didn't really cover in that chapter, but with that centralized ledger comes income taxes, because or at least it makes them more widely enforceable, because with widespread financial surveillance is where you get the ability and the desire, and then it becomes normalized that you surveil everybody's, you know, like accounting their entire year and then take a percentage of it. Whereas in those older eras where you had a more distributed and more private monetary structure, income was a less easy thing to tax, right? Because it's harder to surveil everyone's life in that arrangement. And so taxes had to be placed on just more transparent things on average, or more uniform ways. And so it kind of, the technology both centralizes in that era and then also shapes just how politics works, how public finances work, and what our kind of baseline expectations for privacy are. And it, a lot of it was just not a, like apparent to the people at the era. It's always like you're replacing a ship one plank at a time. And after 100 years, it's a completely different ship.
It's a rocket ship.
Yeah.
Okay, so obviously the book makes a lot of good points about why money is broken and the problems with the current monetary system around the world. And of course, we've spoken a little bit so far about how Bitcoin improves and all of those things. Tell us more about it. We could never get enough Bitcoin propaganda here at the Bitcoin Standard podcast. So why does Bitcoin fix the money?
I think the biggest reason it fixes it is because, as we discussed, it pierces the 160 different currency borders in a more effective way than we've seen before. And it's really the first viable solution to have fast settlements that are also decentralized, and that no one can just arbitrarily inflate it. No one can arbitrarily censor it. There's actually a cost to imposing a rule over the Bitcoin network. You either have to get, you know, over half of the mining, or you have to, you know, otherwise find a way to exploit it. And so, and then as we discussed, it just keeps getting more and more liquid over time. One of the things I've thought about a lot is, because people have liked to compare Bitcoin's adoption pattern to other technologies. And so some of the critics have argued that it's not adopting as quickly as others. Like, for example, more people adopted ChatGPT than have a self-custody Bitcoin, you know, this year, compared to Bitcoin's whole lifetime. And one thing I've thought about, and I touched on briefly in the book, is that most technologies, being non-monetary, have a very smooth adoption pattern because they're not really leverageable. Like if someone makes the radio and you go out and buy the radio, you have a radio now, and most people never want to go back to not having a radio. Same thing for electrification, same thing for the television, same thing for the internet, same thing for smartphones. As a new technology is introduced, it has this very smooth exponential growth pattern. Whereas if the good that's being adopted, the new technology that's being adopted, is money, that's inherently going to be a bumpier and arguably slower process because it's inherently leverageable. So as soon as someone starts seeing that exponential curve upward, a lot of people's immediate reaction is to leverage it, but then by leveraging it, they cause bubbles. And then when you get one of those, like, you know, hype bubbles, human nature buys into that. And then when people lose a lot of money, they're, you know, if they didn't deeply understand what they were buying in the first place, which is true for most technology, you don't deeply understand the radio the first time you buy it. You don't deeply understand a television. You don't deeply understand the internet. You just know what it's solving for you. And so people buy into it, into a bubble. That bubble collapses due to leverage and speculation. It takes years to work back. And so a monetary technology, people actually do revert back to not adopting it, or at least a percentage of them. So if you get, you know, a million new people in, you know, maybe 300,000 of them leave during the bear market because they say, no, I made a mistake. This is a scam. And then it has to build back up slowly and have another wave of adoption and then another credit bubble, and then people de-adopt it. And so one thing that's kind of fascinating about watching Bitcoin monetize, and part of, I think, a case for, you know, kind of the Talebs of the world, or the critics that argue that it's being ineffective or slow, is that this type of technology almost cannot adopt quickly, especially when you're up against such a powerful network effect. And so kind of the way that I end the book is to say there's really two forks in the road here. Either Bitcoin wins and the open source money kind of connects to the world and solves these 160 different, like, currency firewalls around borders, or otherwise it's just more and more centralization. Basically, central bank digital currencies get even tighter locks on their own people, on their own borders, and that's that's, I think, not a future that most people should wish for. And one reason I make the, I try to appeal to a lot of different types of people in the book. That's why I try to steelman different views of money and try to talk as broadly as possible, is basically to say, look, there's really two paths here, and one path is bad for almost everyone. And so you should really support and increase the odds of this technology being robust and accepted, and instead of slowing it down, which means it can, you know, it takes longer to positively affect people's lives, people can do their role to accelerate it. And that the faster, the larger it gets, the more it can fix things, or at least the faster it can fix things for people in our lifetime rather than just the next lifetime. I think that's the powerful thing about it, is that it's highly portable money, and it's the first serious technology that pierces financial borders between people, because instead of just going through banks and airports, it's point to point, potentially between everyone. So unless a country wants to be like North Korea and just completely isolate itself, it's going to have a very, very hard time preventing Bitcoin, stablecoins, basically like the market for money, and more broadly, the market for investable goods is a lot more marketable now. That basically that it's brought to, it's, these are reducing inefficiencies in the market and having everybody in the world be able to compete for the best assets, rather than just compete in their own ledger, in their own little ecosystem. And the current arrangement is that really only rich people in a lot of these countries can get offshore assets. They have access to global markets. They can get an offshore bank account, an offshore brokerage account, and it takes time for that to kind of go down to the middle class, the working class. And what this does is it reduces the overhead, and it brings that to people around the world, whether their governments like it or not.
Yeah. Your final section of the book discusses Bitcoin and human rights. That's something that I haven't really discussed much in detail in my work. I tend to try and appeal to people's greed, because I think that's a lot more effective than trying to appeal to people's virtues, because let's face it, greed is a lot more, is a lot better sell. But what is your thesis on why Bitcoin helps human rights?
Going back to that part I discussed, it basically, when you're trapped in your in a currency bubble, your options are far more limited, and the people running that bubble have a lot more control over you. And so my argument is that the more tools you can give to people to have more autonomy in their own lives, you know, either access to globally better assets, or best yet, access to just literally fully decentralized money that you can literally self-custody, gives you a lot more options. And then your ability, if you're debanked, if you're constantly dealing with inflation, the fact that you can hold this asset and then make permissionless payments to other people, that is a very powerful human rights technology. And I do think in the long arc of time, greed's the most important variable. And it's part of, so open source has always had the challenge, which is that if it's not super profitable to work on, what's going to make people want to adopt it? And what's going to make people want to work on it? And the cool thing about Bitcoin is that it's open source, but it also gives you an incentive along with it. And I think that's why it's going to be more successful than almost any other open source project in history. But I also think that appealing to people's emotions and appealing to people's kind of ethical frameworks is relevant, especially for certain types of people. And so you have pockets, either individuals or institutions, where especially if there's a lot of propaganda against it, there has to be kind of point by point answers to those kind of propaganda against it, or you need to develop such like a kind of, just even if you're just not responding to their point, if you're building a case for why it is a good thing, and someone reads that and it's compelling to them, then when they go out and hear the arguments against it, they have answers. They have like a shield against kind of like the lower grade criticisms that you'll hear of Bitcoin. So what I try to do in that section is say, it's not just about rich people getting richer, which is like a criticism you see. It's, you know, this is a tool of empowerment for people all around the world. And I find that, you know, that's a message that appeals. I mean, we ask in the Bitcoin community, why is it so male dominated, or why is it more right leaning? And I think there's natural reasons for that, but it's like, you can still get ways of adoption from other groups by appealing to other facets of what Bitcoin fixes. And so I try to kind of bring that in a way that speaks to as many types of people as possible, Like, and there's, I mean, there's certain groups I'm just going to write off. Like, I'm not going to try to convince a communist why they should adopt Bitcoin. They're just not, it's not, we're not, we don't speak the same language. So it's not going to be a thing. But if someone's remotely in a language that I can speak to, then I try to speak to them.
Yeah, I agree entirely. Well, I'm perhaps not being very truthful there. I'm not nowhere near as diplomatic as you. So I could agree in theory, but I can't pull it off in practice. All right, I want to ask you on your chapter on the petrodollar. I got to admit, I'm a little bit skeptical on the idea that the dollar is backed by, that the dollar system is a petrodollar system. Give us your best pitch. I go back and forth, but tell us why you think it is a petrodollar system.
So one thing I do in the book is I often call it the eurodollar / petrodollar system, because it is both, it's not just that, is a point. So you'll see often people's, I find that the two camps of this, like the two extremes, to be neither fully correct. So some people say it's only because of deals in OPEC, for example. That's why the dollar has its power. I disagree with that. Other people say, no, those deals had no impact at all. I think basically what we're witnessing is a powerful network effect occasionally do actions to keep the network effect going. Basically, when it in the 1970s, when the Bretton Woods system ended, it's like the dollar had its shields down. Like it had this ongoing massive network effect. It was still the largest economy, the largest military, but there was suddenly a problem in the sense that for the first time in the world, all these different countries had no reliable ledger that couldn't just be printed by someone else. So up till that era, basically gold was some sort of foundation for the system, or bimetallic standards, or you know, whatever the case may be. Under Bretton Woods, it was the gold-backed dollar. And now there was kind of like monetary chaos for a period of time where, you know, the dollars that we had this era of like double digit inflation. The U.S. was getting embargoed for oil, you know, for geopolitical reasons due to its own decisions and basically the whole geopolitical mix that was happening. And so it was kind of like this moment where the shields were down and they still have this massive network effect. And so they say, well, let's use our military force. Let's use the powers we have to keep this going for another cycle. And so it's unclear exactly what would have happened without those, but it is documented that the Nixon administration, for example, went to Saudi Arabia and went to other countries and said, look, here's the deal we're going to make. And the only reason they could make that deal is because they already had the liquidity, they already had the network effects. You know, like Switzerland couldn't go out and make this deal, or you know, Canada couldn't go out and make this deal. The remnants of the currency that had the remnants of the Bretton Woods system is the one that could make these deals, and they chose to do so to strengthen it. So basically, it's the idea that in addition to the dollar having already achieved the best saleability among monies, they further strengthened it. And they said, look, if you want to be able to buy oil from these countries, you have to do it in dollars, and we're going to entice these entities that are very rich now to want to hold their cash balances in dollar equivalents, in bonds. So it's like basically it could have been an era where the dollar fell, or it could have been an era that a multipolar world opened up a little bit more quickly. And instead, I think they just solidified their network effect by shoring up some of their weaknesses and kind of ensuring that both in terms of demand for it and in terms of cash balances were maintained by using other resources that they had, which is like they're basically their military assets.
Yeah, I think I have to say, like I was sympathetic to this viewpoint, but while writing the Fiat Standard, I've come to think that the thing that matters the most is the fact that the treasury market is the largest, most liquid market in the world. And I think everything else is largely window dressing next to that supremely important fact. So you could point to deals with Saudi Arabia. I think this is probably the most compelling point is the one that you mentioned in your book. I think it's chapter 11, I think it is, yeah. But you mentioned the deal that they did with Saudi Arabia with King Faisal in the 1970s. And the terms of the deal was that the U.S. would provide protection weapons and the Saudis would buy U.S. treasuries and price the oil in dollar. Now, I don't think pricing the oil in dollar is anything other than psychological. In reality, you can price it in whatever you want and you can take payment in whatever you want. There's no strict way of enforcing what Saudi Arabia will take as payment from another country. The thing that really makes this viable is not the fact that presidents and treasury secretaries and kings signed on a deal. I think it's just the economic reality of Saudi Arabia, like China, like India, like Brazil, like the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund. They need to have their cash balances in the most saleable asset. And at that level, you know, for the level of people you and I know in Egypt and Lebanon, the most saleable asset is a $100 bill or a dollar stablecoin. But when you're a sovereign wealth fund, when you're the Saudi royal family, you're operating at a different level. And at that level, the only place where you can go in and out with significant volume without significant slippage, the only place where you can get, or the place where you can find the least bid-ask spread, the place where you can affect the market the least at large volume, is the treasury market. Perhaps, I think, you know, a lot of politics is, I liken it sometimes to people, you know, when you give your child a plastic steering wheel so that they can put on their car seat and then they play around with it and you tell them to help you drive. And they think they're driving the car and it makes them feel better. I think a lot of politics is like that. So a lot of trade agreements are, in a sense, like that, that politicians like to think that they're the ones that are facilitating trade. But really, people would be trading on their own and you're just not getting in the way, if anything. And I think perhaps maybe this is the case here, in the case of the petrodollar system, that the reality is that the treasury continues to be the biggest market in the world. And that's just the way that the fiat monetary system functions, and it's the way that the fiat system has functioned since before the fiat system. The growth of the bond market in the 19th century in Europe was significant, a hugely significant development. And it meant enormous amounts of financing in the hands of government because it gave a lot of power to the governments. Effectively, government bonds are the money. When we say dollars, really what we mean is government bonds. That's the big boy money. And that's not the money for the normal people. But the real money is government bonds. And I think, what do you think of the idea that it's just the size of the bond market is what determines that? And that's why the Chinese have been talking about getting out of bonds since 2008. I remember this 2008 financial crisis. I remember Chinese officials and central bank officials saying, our exposure to U.S. government bonds is too high. It's not healthy. It's not good. And yet they're still roughly around at the same range that they've been at that time. 15 years on, they still hold around $1 trillion of bonds. Granted, $1 trillion today is not $1 trillion in 2008, so that's a drop in real terms, but in nominal terms, it's still constant. And even as relationships of the U.S. with other countries deteriorate, these countries continue to hold government bonds. In fact, Russia, even after significant deterioration with Russia, it wasn't Russia that dumped its dollar holdings. It was the U.S. that confiscated them. So I think maybe the case is not that it is a geopolitical alliance. It's not about oil. It's just the economic reality that the treasury is the most liquid market. What do you think?
So I think there's a couple. I partially agree, partially disagree, but it's about basically about percentages. So I do think that the depth of capital markets, not just treasuries, but even things like, you know, now you see like major central banks will own, or sovereign wealth funds will own, U.S. equities too. So it's both the treasury market and just the overall depth of U.S. capital markets. And that's part of why the euro has not been successful in international adoption, is that they have fractured capital markets. And so even though they've linked their currencies together, they don't have that same depth of liquidity for their capital markets. And so that's where I fully agree. That's a massive factor. Having one giant deep capital market, including the treasury market, is a really important factor. But there's a couple of, one is that back in the 70s, U.S. debt to GDP was something like 30% debt to GDP. It was not quite the market it was now. And also gold's market cap was a lot bigger back then. And so that was a more serious competition at the time between what you want to hold your sovereign reserves in. Because if you want to liquidate things next week, then the treasury would be better. But sovereign reserves are kind of meant to be held for like decades, or at least a portion of them. And so if you kind of do long-term planning and say, well, what do we want to hold value the best versus what percentage do we want to have more quickly liquidatable? You can make an argument, especially back then, where you, as a central bank, you want to hold some percentage in gold and then another percentage in things like treasuries. And so this is basically a way of trying to pull more from the gold and keep it from you know, being too gold focused versus treasury focused. So basically it draws a little bit more cash balances towards treasuries. It also solved some of the inflationary problems that the US was having at the time, because it got them better access to oil. And so part of even making the treasury attractive is that you have to have that positive real yield for most of the time, and to show the world, like, this is all happening. This deal was 3 years after 1971. And so imagine, like, from that perspective, what people's probability assessment was that completely unbacked currency was going to work for any significant length of time, especially with the inflation levels that were happening. So I think when we put ourselves in the mind at the time, the treasury market was not necessarily insured to be that stable. There's even a period of time in the late 70s where the US issued debt in German marks and Swiss francs, a small amount of debt. They called them Carter bonds because it happened under his presidency. And it was a way to, like, build a small amount of reserves and try to actually gain confidence in the dollar. That there was a lot of questions around the dollar during the 70s, and just towards the broader idea of, is fiat currency even going to work? And so that's why I think that some of those steps were relevant for solidifying the network effect they had. When it comes to Russia, an interesting thing there is they had mostly dumped their treasuries prior to the war. What they didn't dump was their euro assets, and those were frozen too. So it was almost like it was arguably a strategic miscalculation that they didn't necessarily, they kind of knew that if they could do this, the US is going to freeze it. So they already dumped that. But I think with the gas reliance from Europe, they probably assumed that Europe would not also do that. And so they were already de-dollarizing because they had that incentive to do so. China is an interesting case because they announced in 2013 or so that it was no longer in their interest to keep accumulating treasuries. And that while they didn't collapse their treasury holdings, they went down from, say, like 1.3 trillion to like 900 billion, which in real terms is even more. Now, there's some evidence that some percentage of that they actually hold through other entities. So some of the treasuries we see in other countries are actually attributable at the end of the day to China. It's almost like a little way of kind of just subtly laundering a little bit of it. But I think the bigger story is that during that decade-long period, they're still running massive trade surpluses the whole time. And so even if you just stay flat in terms of your treasury holdings, the question is, why are those cash balances not increasing? Like, what else are you doing with your dollars, if not that? And the answer for China, at least, has been that they've been kind of engaging in the same sort of policies that the US and Europe do, where they will then take those dollars and they'll make deals or loans with countries around the world. They're basically saying, we're going to skip the middleman. And so they hold treasuries for the liquid part of their holdings, but then for the illiquid longer term stuff, they basically will go and make a deal with a Latin American country and say, we're going to buy, you know, this many commodities over this many years, or we're going to buy this stake in this refiner, or we're going to make a loan that if you default on that loan, we get the airport. It's a little bit more kind of hard asset financing or commodity linked financing. And of course, the downside with that is it's illiquid, it's spread across jurisdictions, but it also, in their view, diversifies their exposure so that they have the liquid portion, which is censorable by Washington, and then they have the illiquid portion that gets them what they want at the end of the day, which is those commodity exposures, those resources, and is not censorable by Washington, or is much harder to censor by Washington. And so I think we have seen a meaningful shift in that sense, and that's why I do think that some of these moments in time, particularly the 70s, there were these periods where, like, the shields were down. And so I think that some of the geopolitical things were relevant, but they were only relevant in the context where you already have this massive monetary saleable network effect to even work from.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. All right, so what do you make of the euro-dollar system? A lot of people keep harping on about the euro-dollar system. Does a Bitcoiner need to know anything more than the fact that this is just a crappier dollar and it's going to get eaten by Bitcoin?
I think all they have to know is that the network effect's really big. That it's you know, I think the only thing to know really, and you cover this well in fiat standard, is that debt is basically demand for that currency. Right, because you know, basically, anytime you contractually, you owe something in a unit, you now have inflexible demand for that unit. This is something that a lot of macro analysts have been covering for a while. Basically, if you have $13 trillion worth of dollar denominated debt outside of the country, all of that is demand for dollars. And this also shows the saleability and the liquidity and the dominance of the dollar network, which is that most of those dollars are not even owed to the U.S. They're owed to like other non-U.S. entities. So like Europe will lend dollars to Argentina, or China will lend dollars to Pakistan, whatever the case may be. The majority of those $13 trillion are not even owed to the U.S. In fact, the U.S. is a net debtor nation on a worldwide basis. There's that big entrenched multi-trillion dollar inflexible demand for dollars out there. And so this is basically just, it just kind of shows the scale of the network effect that Bitcoin is up against. And it can affect, you know, by understanding that, it can affect your thesis for how long, you know, Bitcoin adoption can take relative to the scale of what you're up against here.
And so in terms of actionable information, how is this relevant? Does it change your fundamental thesis of stacking sats for the long term? In any case, how does it affect your fiat investment theses?
It doesn't really. It only just, I think it only affects the language I would use, or I think it's managing your expectations around time for adoption. Now, of course, the world is an uncertain and nonlinear place. So you can't just model out like, okay, this is how long it's going to take Bitcoin to reach these prices. But I think basically it just kind of tempers the reality of the situation of how long something like money takes to transfer over if we think about the likely probability path. And you know, I think you arrived at a similar conclusion in Fiat Standard, where you basically said that this system's actually kind of long lasting in its design. It's not something that just kind of goes away overnight, most likely. And so I think basically that's a point I would agree with, is that this is, you know, it's not like the dollar's going to fail like 2 years from now. Like this is a very entrenched network effect that has purposely entrenched a lot of its own demand into the system on a global basis, that is inflexible, and that would take major geopolitical things to shift. And Bitcoin has to kind of over time work through that. In addition, there's, you know, if you look at Bitcoin price next to global broad money supply denominated in dollars, there's quite a lot of correlation. Basically, it's as correlated as like the halving cycle is in terms of Bitcoin, which is all these major Bitcoin bull markets are occurring during rising periods of global liquidity. So either banks and central banks are creating a lot of money and credit, or the dollar's weakening relative to many other major currencies because it goes through these cycles. And so basically the unit of account that the world uses is softening, and that all their debt is denominated in, or a lot of their debt is softening. And so from any sort of like just expectations angle, like what can Bitcoin do over 18 months? What can it do? Is it likely to be in a bear market for 18 months or bull market for 18 months? Understanding a little bit about the dollar system can be relevant there, but I personally don't really try to trade Bitcoin. All I try to do is set expectations around Bitcoin. When Bitcoin is depressed, I'm saying, you know, this is interesting from a timing standpoint. When it's euphoric, I'm saying I'm not like digging into my cold storage and selling, but it's like we have to have expectations here around risk management and to kind of not have people go in over enthused and get wrecked. And maybe people have to get wrecked to kind of fully learn and go down the rabbit hole. But I think if our job as an analyst is to try to minimize wreckage for anyone who we can.
All right. Well, we're gonna end with the most intellectually deep question anybody could ask: when moon?
I think the next time we have another global liquidity cycle, which kind of ties in our prior point. I think it'd be hard to moon, not impossible, hard to moon until we get another liquidity cycle. Mm-hmm. And I'd be very surprised to see another liquidity cycle that doesn't come with another moon. So I think that I expect that relationship to probably hold for another period of time.
So you would think that global liquidity matters more than the halving cycle?
I think they're both relevant. It's been weird. So the sample size so far is not big. And so far, both have been present during all major Bitcoin bull markets. And so the halving cycle, you know, that will take off 450 Bitcoin per day, roughly. Whereas the global liquidity, it can affect what trillions of dollars in capital do over, say, an 18-month period. And so it can affect whether or not certain billions flow into Bitcoin or not, or what percentage. And so in terms of kind of mapping out the magnitudes, I would say that's perhaps is a more important variable, at least in that timing sense. I mean, basically, if Bitcoin didn't have the halvings, that'd be a totally different discussion. So nothing's really more important than Bitcoin's hardness. But in the context of what triggers performance over an 18-month period, so far, we've only had instances where those have coincided. And I think the funny thing, again, is they might coincide again. So like, and that's also why you don't see perfect, like, you know, when the Bitcoin halving happens, the length of the bull market after that can be different. And a lot of that is tied to, you know, does liquidity occur exactly when the halving happens? Does it occur a little bit before the halving? Does it occur a little bit after the halving? That partly explains why we get different lengths of bull markets, that kind of thing. So again, I don't really use it as like a tradable thing, but I do track global liquidity because basically what you're tracking is the hardness of the other money you're competing with, which I think is, of course, a relevant variable if we're comparing two monies competing. And the fluctuations of the bigger money are arguably going to matter more than the, you know, the changes in the smaller money, even though both of them are highly relevant.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a very strong opinion on this. I'm open to either of these things happening. And I think I agree with you that we're likely not going to get a clean test of it because it just doesn't look like we're going to. I mean, who knows? I don't really follow the Fed very closely, and I'm not a Fed analyst, but it seems to me that they've been tightening for a while. You know, the Krugmans of the world have been banging the drum of this is the war over inflation has been won. It's time to ease again. And if they start easing any time now up until the end of 2024, so over the next 14 months, that's going to effectively coincide with the halving cycle. And so I believe it's more likely than not that they will ease between the next 14 months. And I'm no expert about those things, just my rough guess. And so that is going to be difficult to disentangle from the halving, because generally the halving pump can happen a few months before, a few months after. And it seems like we're going to be getting easing around that time. So we're not going to get a clear answer on this. But my intuition tells me that Bitcoin is still too small as a global asset to be driven by macro cycles. I still think it's more likely that it is driven by its own supply dynamics. So I would expect that even if we don't get liquidity easing over the next 12, 14 months, I'd still expect a pump of sort to happen, just because there's going to be a significant decrease in the amount of liquidity that's being added every day onto the market, and that can only be alleviated through price increases, quantitative hardening, as we like to call it. But we'll see.
Yeah, assuming the demand flow stays steady, the halving should take care of itself. So if we don't see a drop in liquidity, if liquidity just kind of stays roughly where it is, the halving should be beneficial. I think a bad liquidity environment could potentially override that. A good liquidity environment would add to it. And then there's even other things like whether or not there's a spot Bitcoin ETF, because all these things are access points from the bigger money into the smaller but better money. And so it's basically just tracking two monies. And one thing I generally find is when looking at Bitcoin, the first like third or the first half of its existence didn't really correlate with anything on the macro scale. On the second half of its existence, it has, I think, been big enough and liquid enough that it is affected by macro, in the sense that liquidity is very important for Bitcoin price, but also Bitcoin price matches onto liquidity better than most other assets do. It's kind of been one of the more pure liquidity correlations, which is interesting. And I guess it would make sense in the sense that it's, people often describe it as like an inflation hedge, but really it's, and they, when they think of that, they think of price, but really what it is, it's a monetary inflation protector. And so it would make sense that it gets more adoption in periods of faster monetary inflation, especially when measured in dollars, because that's the major one you're competing against, really. And so, yeah, I think we'll find out. But I think, unfortunately, the debate's going to continue for another 4 years, because I would expect that they're probably going to somewhat coincide again.
Yeah, and it could also be resolved if we get a halving and we get easing and Bitcoin doesn't pump. Let's not forget that.
Yeah.
That yeah. Possibility would end the debate in a way that basically everybody loses and the fiaters would win.
Yeah.
So let's hope it doesn't come to that.
I agree.
All right. Well, Lynn, thank you so much for your time. This has been as fascinating as ever, and wish you best of luck with your book. Tell us a little bit more about where people can find you and your work online.
they can check out lindalden.com. That's where I have most of my research. They can also go to, at lindaldencontact on Twitter, and they can check out the book. The lame way, I guess, would be Amazon, and the cool way would be thesafehouse.com.
Excellent. Thank you for the plug, and we'll see you soon.